to this edition of the EV Cafe podcast. This is a podcast for the innovators, collaborators, movers and shakers of the EV industry. We are joined by none other than the wonderful John Curtis. How are you today?
Oh, do you know what? I am absolutely buzzing. I'm dangerous. So let's move on.
Oh, he is. Anybody watching this on YouTube, he is wearing a bright red shirt and he's buzzing because we've just done the wonderful EV Cafe news, which was deemed to be our most informative and entertaining yet. But this webinar, this podcast is all about you, Matt Adams from the REA, which is the Renewable Energy Association. Matt is the Transport Policy Manager at the REA, an all-round legend. Hello, Matt.
Yeah, great to be here.
Hello, mate.
He's had to put up with some technical difficulties this morning, but we are all smiling and we love to have guests on the show who can really lift the lid on things that are going on behind the scenes. And then in turn, we lift the lid on them. What makes them tick? What makes them outstanding in our field? And I had the pleasure of spending part of this week with Matt at the REA's offices in London. Maybe we'll start there. What were we doing? What does the REA do? Why do people need to know about it?
Sure. So let's start with what is the REA? So the REA, Renewable Energy Association, it's the largest and oldest energy trade association in the country, with around 500 member companies at the moment. On Tuesday, we were looking at our EV forum. So our EV forum has about 100 to 150 members working on EV infrastructure, whether it's the charge point operators, local authorities, EMSPs, consultants, green finance, legal, insurance, etc. The list goes on. But what we're doing at the forum meeting is we're talking about the public charge point regulations and the guidance that just come out. And we had the Office of Product and Safety Standards in that day. And it was actually a really useful conversation, I think, understanding just about how they're actually going to go about enforcement. We learned quite a lot actually about how they actually select sites and things to go look at in the first place, which I thought was quite interesting. They basically just look at people's websites and go, oh, okay, their website's lacking a bit of detail. Let's go take a look at their site and go from there. So that was actually quite useful for our members to find out. And then we talked a little bit about the rest of the stuff that the REA is doing at the moment and some of our parliamentary engagement we've had recently. We're at Labour conference. We had a round table with Ruth Cadbury, the Transport Select Committee Chair, Bill Esterson, the ESNES Select Committee Chair, and a few other MPs as well. So it was actually a really nice bit of talk about that.
It's crazy the amount of work that you have to shoulder, and yet you're always jovial, joyful, and smiling. And you must have a ridiculous inbox. I mean, the public charge point regulations themselves are a huge lumbering beast, and I know a lot of our EV Cafe audience need to understand the ins and outs of that, but behind the scenes your role is to kind of coordinate the feedback from the market, from the REA members, and feed that directly into OZEB. Are you able to give us a bit of a snapshot, maybe an overview of the main highlights that you're seeing the charge point operators reporting back with?
Sure. So I suppose if we go back all the way to 2022, when the first consultation came out, the consumer experience consultation, we saw at the time there's quite a lot of feedback, particularly around the reliability elements and contactless payment requirements that were quite interesting. And it was very clear that at the time the government were going to mandate that we had to have contactless on a lot of the charge points immediately, which obviously would have been quite difficult to get going, particularly with quite a small supply chain. So luckily we were able to feed that back to government, and that then got moved to 12 months in, so it gave people a bit more time to get ready for that, which is great. And then more recently we've seen over the last year we've been working with OZEV on reliability, and on the reliability requirements in particular, it came to things like, what actually counts as uptime, downtime, and what's exempt. And for us it was it's a feedback that if someone is icing, surely that's not the charge point operator's fault, and that shouldn't count as part of the part of the downtime and things like that. So the way the regulations were written, it did count originally. And so having that extra guidance over the lot that came out on Monday this week really has helped, I think, a lot of the charge point operators, which was really good to see.
Matt, you spoke about being a representative organisation for about 500 businesses, and that consultation processes happen to feed back on government suggestions for legislation. It's a really daft laddie question, so I don't know the answer to this. The 500 businesses on their own would have 500 inputs to the consultation process, potentially. The REA has one feedback for the consultation process. Do you get like 500 times more airtime, if you like, because you are that bigger organisation, and that gives you a synergy because you're coming at it together?
You know what? It does, yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, the important thing really to note is that, you know, obviously over the last nearly 22 years since we've been an organisation, we've built up really good relationships with all arms of government. And so when we do the consultations, you know, we're also not just writing the consultation responses, and we work with, you know, sometimes 10s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 100 organizations, depending on the topic, on a consultation response. And, you know, you learn so much during that process, because, and trust me, there's always more to learn on this. What we tend to find is once we submit the response, we tend then to start working with government behind the scenes. So we say, okay, well, we've submitted the response, you can see exactly what we've said, but now we want to get into the detail, and we go and we try and be a bit more proactive instead of just sitting on our laurels for 6 months until the consultation response comes out. We then go and do a bit more work behind the scenes, and that's what I think maybe makes us a bit different from just, you know, submitting 500 individual consultations. You're able to constantly give that feedback over the next, you know, 6, 8, 10 months.
And what's your sense, Matt, of how the new government views the move to more renewables, the move to electric vehicles, the need for storage locally, the potential for hydrogen? It's a massive area, but I'm not getting a sense that government is rushing into huge investment and new legislation.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. So I think it would be fair to say that maybe, you know, when we did our like 100 days document, I know EV Cafe covered a while back, you know, we were maybe hoping for a little more progress on a few things, and it's been a little slower than maybe we'd like. But I think, you know, overall it was clear from the manifesto that there are some quite high level commitments in there around EV. I mean, yeah, you know, I think there is stuff in there around, you know, accelerating charge point rollout. Now, obviously, that's a pretty open-ended statement, so, you know, on the plus side, that enables people like ourselves to go in and tell them how they can do that. Although, obviously, for most people, barriers to charging rollout isn't a new thing, and OZEV already know a lot of the barriers already, and they were working on them before the election. So, you know, we hope really, if anything else, just the good work that OZEV are doing continues behind the scenes to move that forward. But yeah, I think Labour are committed, and they've got a lot of what would be the best way of putting it? A lot of enthusiasm, and I'm just waiting to see what that enthusiasm comes, you know, actually pays off with. But yeah, we're getting there slowly.
Good. Well, you certainly are, and I'm endlessly impressed by your ability, you personally, to kind of coordinate all of that messaging, all that input, all of those companies coming through to you. I know the REA has got different sort of segments within it, and you're the one I see the most, but even just yesterday you were putting, I'm on the interoperability and roaming group, for example, and there's due to be a survey about that, because the intricacies of these sort of mandation documents when they come out seem like a really good idea. Everyone goes, oh yeah, that'll work. But it's only when you start getting together collaboratively to say, we've kind of spotted a bit of a problem, and that's how we then go through you at the REA to make a bit more clout to that. And I just want to congratulate you for that, and I want to understand where your capacity comes from. What do you think brought you to be able to be so good at this role, because you are pretty phenomenal.
No, oh, thanks. So obviously, always nice to hear that. I think, you know, part of it is just the fact that when I left uni, I was so sort of maybe I had such an open mind as to what I wanted to do. And what I learned very quickly is how to pick up information very quickly. So I started off working in the water sector and did that for about 6-8 months. And then I ended up working for Drax. I worked there for about 2 years and we were doing a bit of everything. So I was doing, so policy analyst there. So I was doing carbon capture one day, forestry sustainability another day, pumped hydro storage another, and EVs as well, and a bit on sustainable aviation fuel, hydrogen, all sorts of things. So, and heat pumps and all sorts. So I think for me, it's just the fact I've always been able to pick up new things quite quickly. And I suppose how I do that is probably just the fact that I've always been playing catch up. And I always think I've been playing catch up to like catch up things. There's always new things out there. And with this role in particular, you're always one step behind. And so you're always having to chase, chase information and get things done. And after a while, you just do it. But it takes a while.
John and I are just messaging because we're trying to take guesses on what you studied at university. Now I'm saying geography with environmental science because that's what I did. And that is, you can only complete that course if you can take in so much information about so many different subjects at any one time. John, get your guess in. What was it?
My guess is divinity. Because divinity. I just got this feeling that you are a deeply values-driven human being who sees the broadest context for society, and you're just a good person. What was your degree in?
Oh, so it was in politics, actually. So I did politics and international relations. But, with that, I have to say that because I only had 6 hours a week of lectures, I actually had a lot more time to think and do other things, which definitely helped. But I think how I sort of found my way into environment in particular was because I was doing an environment policy module and a policy module separately to that. And so I was learning a lot about environmental politics. We learned about all the COPs and things like that. And in particular, looking at air quality. And that really started to get me interested in public transport and road transport. And then I finished my undergrad. And of course, what everyone does before they start a master's, they go, well, I've still got no idea. And so I did a master's and did it in public policy. The whole aim for that was to do a dissertation around decarbonizing public transport. So the transport bit was always the bit I was most interested in, but it just took me 2 or 3 jobs to get to it.
Absolutely. But I'm celebrating my 20th year in transport infrastructure this year, which is completely nuts. And much like you, it's really interesting to hear your political degree included those environmental modules, because my environmental modules included a political module. So we also learned all about the COPs, and it really brings home to me on the news, on the EV Cafe news today, we were talking about the importance of the skills gap and closing that gap, and how terrifying it is that there's so many people out there who don't have visibility on our industry, or how indeed to get into it. And I actually think there's a bit of a niche there for you, Matt. I think you're very relatable, very personable. Imagine if you started to be more open about your pathway. How could you do that?
Good question. Well, I mean, I think earlier this year, we did do a skills report. We did look at the whole EV sector. Part of the reason I did that was because I felt that it was something that wasn't talked about enough in the sector. Like, although lots of people say, there's a skills gap and it's important, and you go, okay, well, what are we doing about it? And they go, so we thought it was really important to get the skills gap, get skills report out there and talk a lot more about, in particular looking at engineers and electricians, how we can encourage more people into that. And you've probably seen Net Zero Evolution have launched Net Zero Heroes, and I've signed up to that. And so I really want to go out and do more of that public engagement and talk to people, because I think, that's the most powerful way you can make change, is actually going out there and talking and inspiring people. And so that's what I would like to get, that's what I would like to do. And so in terms of like talking about my pathway in particular, I would definitely like to bring that in and talk about I have actually gone back to my university. I went back to Cardiff and did talk to them about how I started how I started work and all of that. And so certainly something I want to do more of if I can.
Good, you should.
You were talking about being inspiring, and we have in 5 days time the budget, which is something which will hopefully be used to inspire people and give confidence and certainty in our area. As somebody who writes policy for the REA, presumably you'll be standing by on budget day to hear every announcement and what the impacts will be for our world. What are you expecting
Come through?
Very good question. I think, you know, what they'll probably do is they'll re-announce the rapid charging fund in some way and say, oh, look, we've found this £900 billion that has been sitting there for a while, and we're finally going to spend it. That would be great. We've also been speaking to the OZEV grant teams quite a lot over the last few months, and we're particularly pushing for things around improved grant funding for HGV and vans, ensuring that, you know, as Paul would say with the van plan, that we extend the van plug-in grant. And then we're also looking at things around can we make it easier for people to, you know, afford a charge point or an installation? So although that home plug-in grant has ended, we've got a cross-pavement grant coming in now, but the cost of that, but it's only £350. And if you want to get planning permission to install the charge point, that costs you about £250-350. So the grant doesn't actually pay for anything. And so what we'd like to do is to see that increased as well. We've been talking to OZEV about that. So yeah, there are a few things that we're pushing for behind the scenes, and yeah, we hope to see at least one of those in the budget, hopefully.
Because it must break your heart. You know, we had the United Nations yesterday come out and say that the chances of us keeping the temperature rise to lower than 1.5 degrees C has gone. We've missed it. So now we have to run twice as hard and work twice as hard and diligently to deliver on that massive challenge. And there must be times, Matt, when you sit and think, you know, here I am in the RAA in the UK, which isn't one of the biggest emitters in the world, in fact, quite the opposite. And we've got a global challenge. Because you're brilliant, how do we get you onto the world stage telling people about the experience that you have in the UK in delivering meaningful change?
Well, you know, I did get a chance to do that a little bit last year. So I did get to go out to COP28 for Dubai, in Dubai, and that was great. I did get to chair a panel on decarbonizing transport across the world. We had a panel on Asia, Europe, and the UK, and that was great. Although it did turn out I'd actually broken my ankle just before I'd started chairing that panel. And I broke it the night before, and I was like, well, I've flown all the way out here, and I'm not going to hospital now. I'm going to go the next day once this panel's over, because I refuse to miss this. And so I had quite a lot of paracetamol. I was like, right, I'm just going to crack on and do it. And
crack on.
Yeah.
What's the
story?
Come on, you
gotta
tell us how you broke
your leg. Oh my god, it's so embarrassing. Literally, all I did was I was trying to cross the road, and I got over, you know, there's like islands in the middle of the road, right? Yeah. And put my foot on the grass, and the best way I can describe it is, do you know like a Looney Tunes cartoon where there's like a little bear pit and someone put some leaves over a hole? That's what it was like. There was just a thin layer of grass, and it just gave way underneath. And I planted my foot down, I heard a snap, and I was like, oh no. Limped back to my hotel. The next day limped about 2 miles through the massive complex that was COP28, did the panel. As soon as it finished, I was like, I'm going to take my shoe off. My whole foot was blue. I got straight in an ambulance from COP and went to the hospital there. And they gave me a cast and some crutches. And then I was on a wheelchair most of the time while I was manning our stand for the next week. So,
you're mad.
My gosh, this is insane. That is commitment. I am very, very impressed. You've obviously got a very high pain threshold there. I mean, just before you went on stage, if only I was there, I just said, break a leg, match. And you're quite tall. I'm always obviously being on screen so much, we don't realise this, but that must have been some almighty crack. And kudos to you for carrying on. I would like to think that your high pain threshold comes from the fact that going through these policy documents must be quite painful sometimes. I can imagine. And I'm always in awe. But I'm with you with this one, John. Actually, it was only last month or something, I think, went to the Charge UK evening session. Matt, you were there too, and it was wonderful to see MPs actually getting involved, actually attending and coming along, and she is doing a wonderful job. How often do you get to be with her? Because I think she might be the ticket to getting you out more and more to peddle this message on our behalf.
With Vicky?
Vicky, or is it Ruth? Is that the lady who came along from Parliamentary?
Oh, Lillian Greenwood.
Thank you, Lillian Greenwood. Yes. Yeah, she is really captivating. The way she delivers her piece really makes you connect with what she's saying. Mm-hmm. And she's been incredibly committed in actually turning up, because, you know, they always say, "Oh, someone will be here," and they never, ever come. So, yeah, a combination of you, Vicky, and Lillian would be amazing globally.
Yeah. No, that'd be good fun. I mean, we could do a little road trip or something together. It'd be great.
On tour in 20. Oh, no, we tried that. Yeah. Tour 24. That's what we tried to do. And I want to know what's next, because John's always got his finger on the pulse, and I didn't know the budget was coming out next week, for example, and John does all of our EV Cafe news. So what's the next big milestone in your horizons with the REA?
Oh gosh, well, we've got a few things coming up. So we've got two conferences for the rest of this year. We've got a hydrogen conference and then a decentralized energy conference. And then, you know, next year I've already written agenda for another EV conference that we'll be doing probably around February, March. Our decentralized conference is going to be quite exciting, as we're bringing in people from across all of our membership base. So whether that's solar and battery storage, whether that's EV, whether that's heat and heat networks, we're trying to bring it all together and talk about how all of these guys from different sectors can come together and make a bigger impact and difference. So that'll be really exciting. And going forwards, I'm hoping that we can start bring in some sort of work on microgrids, because I know the CPOs are now looking at solar and battery storage as part of their solutions. So it'd be great for us if we can help them on that path as well, and maybe a bit easier than we have been doing previously with separate forums, but bring it into one group is the aim for next year.
Now, Matt, you mentioned the H word, which for transport aficionados it polarizes people. So in terms of heating and energy storage, obviously hydrogen has its place. In terms of transport, where are we with hydrogen? Is it something which is a blessing in disguise and we will see the value of it and suddenly everybody will be driving hydrogen? Or is it really a bit of a diversion and it's just going to be a pain? Get it gone.
Will everyone be driving hydrogen? Probably not. I think there are use cases for it. So, if you look at things like off-road transport, some of your tractors and things like that, there's potential, and JCBs and things like that are looking at hydrogen at the moment. Then if we look at, people say trucks. I'm not as convinced maybe on trucks myself. I think the REA position is that, for long-haul journeys, hydrogen could play a role for trucks. It could play a role. But I think hydrogen really is going to play a role at an industrial scale, more for industrial power rather than for transport. Absolutely. For transport, if you're looking at, a few years ago when I was looking at decarbonisation of rail, hydrogen could play a role there, for the areas where you can't electrify, and that makes a lot of sense. Similarly, if you look at aviation, I think the shortest haul flight in the world is going to be hydrogen in the next few years. One of the flights from one of the Scottish Islands to the next Scottish Island over, it's a 2-minute flight or something ridiculous. I think that's going the way of hydrogen. I think at the moment short haul is probably the best we can get, but long term, maybe hydrogen will play a role in aviation. It's quite unclear at the moment. We've got the SAF mandate that's come in recently, the sustainable aviation fuel mandate. And we're seeing a slight increasing in blending. We saw that, I think it was Virgin last year, did the first flight with sustainable aviation fuel. So that was really good to see. But hydrogen, I think, still not very clear. Like, if I had a crystal ball, it would still be cloudy, I think.
Not so crystal clear, crystal ball, yeah. Well, I'm completely watching the hydrogen market myself, and it does get a bit of a bashing from the EV community, which I've always found, as I have an overview position like yours, Matt, I've always found that a little short-sighted, because if it's the right application, it still reduces carbon and helps meet targets, then great. But the inefficiencies are insane, the cost is insane. And as for electric flight, a good friend of the EV Cafe, Guy Hedden, who used to work at Zaptec, now works for I can't remember what it's called. We had him on the show and he was explaining how it's a very niche offering to have an electric plane. However, that company wouldn't exist if the charging, he puts in a charging infrastructure at airports, that wouldn't exist without it. And we know that there have been electric flights. The first vertical electric flight happened just near me here in Kemble not so long ago. It looks like a helicopter. It's not. It's like a giant drone with four propellers on its roof called Vertical Aerospace. So yeah, there are all sorts of things happening, but they're all little things happening, you know? So that, yeah, I think, will be the interesting part. Yes, John.
Guy is at AeroVault.
AeroVault, that was it. I was like, it's not aerospace, that's vertical aerospace. They're the ones who do the flying. Guy does the charging. So I'm loving watching all of this. And your role pulls that innovation out of the market. You see it coming before anybody else.
I was actually quite lucky because I got to talk to someone doing a sort of AeroVault style idea with Uber. So they were going to look at doing basically short haul flights for as an Uber that you could just book and turn up and go in. And I said, well, to be honest, I'd probably just rather get an Uber. But yeah, if you can, why not? Could be quite fun.
Yeah, we're going over to, we're taking the EV rally over to Wales next month, and we're going to be actually more in the sort of, we start in Cardiff, we've got Swansea, we're going to go all around Wales. And I know from what you just said, you went to university in Wales, but I'm curious about you. And if Paul Kirby was here, he'd say you, I'm not going to do an impression of his voice, but where do you come from? Where does your drive come from? Where did you grow up? What makes Matt, Matt?
Okay, so yeah, where'd I grow up? So I grew up around just outside of Slough in a village called Iver.
Oh,
excellent. Yeah. So I grew up in Iver and Uxbridge between the two most of the time. One parent each. And then we sort of moved off to Cambridge when I was about like 13, 14, which was very interesting. I was adopted by my aunt and uncle when I was sort of 14. So my sister and I moved up to Cambridge, and we sort of did most of our secondary school and stuff there in college. And so that always ended up being, so that was always very, very big change. But I think what that enabled me to do was pick up things very quickly. So that come back to your question earlier, picking up things very quickly, it was like having to sort of get to grasp of a whole, basically make a whole new load of friends very quickly. And then I've been very lucky actually, because those friends I made for those last 2 years secondary school when I moved to Cambridge are still my best friends today. So there's about seven or eight of us that either live in London now or live across the country, and we all meet up quite often and travel across the country to go see each other, do stupid things like bar crawls and stuff like that, and have a lot of fun. So it was a really childhood was difficult in some ways, but also you get like you get a lot from it. And all of my family was very supportive as well. So they always pushed you and try to get you to go as far as possible. So, with that in mind, I was always driven. And when I was younger, I was like reading about two, three books a week. And it was just like absorbing information. Now I do far less reading, to be honest, as I'm just reading for my day job.
Just reading all day. Yeah, exactly. I would say policy has killed my love of reading. I used to read, now I don't, because when you're poring over documents, and you'll be the same, John, with your legal experience, just you don't want to read when you read all day. You just do not want to do that. Resilience springs to mind.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks very much to how you are such a good people person, Matt, that, you've been through some challenging times. And clearly, I mean, don't want to go into the details of that unless you're happy to. But certainly our childhoods inform who we become as adults, and it can define us, can't it? And it can make us difficult and distant and all those things. Or, as seems to have happened with you, it's almost that sprinkling of fairy dust which makes you go, do you know what? I've had a tough start, but I'm coming back and I'm going to be better, stronger, and there for people.
Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, I think, you know, I don't mind talking about it because, like, I've done it. I've spoken about it before. I was trying to raise some money earlier this year, and I was doing my sponsored run for cancer research. And, you know, there I said that, you know, my dad passed away when I was about 13 from cancer. And so what I did was, you know, I had to even give a speech at his funeral and stuff like that. And so, you know, from then on, public speaking was really not an issue because that was probably the most difficult thing I've ever had to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so it's actually been... So yeah, I didn't really know I was good at public speaking. I didn't really do much after that for a while. And then when I joined the REA, I think it was about a month in, I was doing Fully Charged South on stage with Robert Llewellyn and everyone else. It was like it was crazy. And yeah, it was sort of a bit of an indoctrination of fire. But at the same time, I was like, well, if I could do that, I can definitely do this. And you know, it was nowhere near as bad as I thought it was going to be. And from then on, I've actually quite enjoyed it.
What makes you a good speaker? What do you think are the key things that you have learned over the years that keep you at the top of your game when you're out speaking in public?
Oh, gosh, well, I think a lot of it is preparation, right? So, I mean, yeah, if you try and prepare, and if people are kind enough to give you questions in advance and stuff like that, then what it enables you to do is actually provide some useful insights. Well, I find I'm useless if I don't have information. Like, I normally have a notepad or something, so I always bring a notepad with me and have it on my lap so I can just refer to it and look down and go, oh yes, that really complicated formula, right, that's what it is, and yeah, reel off and do stuff like that. And that really helps. But I think also it's just to remember it, you know, just remembering that the people in the audience aren't always your friends necessarily. You're there to impart knowledge on them. They're more like students, and so you have to, you know, work with them and bring them along the journey. And I think that helps. And also, you know, if it's just a matter of nerves, it's like, okay, just keep your eyes locked on one person in the audience that might look a bit funny or something like that you can just sort of get some reassurance off almost in the background. It's just stuff like that always helps me at least. I have done a few public speaking training for our REA members. I've been I pass stuff like this on them quite a lot. I've got about a half an hour slide deck I walk through with them, then I make them go and do a sort of mock panel in front of everyone, and that always ends up being quite fun. And just then I can see if any of them have been paying attention for the first half an hour or so. And
that's really helpful. Interestingly, Sarah's just messaged me with a horrible thought. Imagining the audience naked helps her, apparently.
You're not supposed to read out my message. I didn't actually mean it like that. I was going to ask you, John, because you do the most public speaking out of all of us. We both co-host the EV Rally. We've all just been at Everything Electric South at Farnborough. And, you know, there's not a week that goes by where we're not required to deliver some kind of thing. Mm. And I laughed when you said preparation, because I was like, well, that would be nice. Chance to be finding. Often you just end up thrust up there with the panel. So, John, question for you. How do you prepare for your public speaking?
Lots of research. So knowing my stuff so that I don't need to think about it. So I go through a process of creating slides, a slide deck of information that I think I'm going to talk about, but don't use it. So I deliver it. I know it because I wrote it. And so I can visualize it when I'm on stage. And so I speak as though I haven't prepared anything. But actually, I've done hours and hours and hours of research prior to the event so that I can pull these things straight off the top of my head. And it's just practice. You know, I've been doing this for 15 years. And so you do get to the point where, as Matt says, I've stood up at my mother's funeral and spoken. Heartbreaking, but somehow you find that inner strength. Once you've done that, once you've done a conference of 1,000 people, once you've done television, you start to believe, well, maybe I can do this. And if people are kind enough to say, you're actually quite good at this, take that on board. My instinct is always to say, oh, stop it. But actually, I've started to absorb some of those positive feedback messages and believe my publicity, that I can actually do this, and that's really helped me. Matt's brilliant at this, and you know that. You know, a lot of people must come up to you and say, you're outstanding. Sarah, you get it all the time. I know you do, because I stand next to you most of the time. And that sort of feedback is critical to us being able to go and do more.
Yeah, the operative where they're being critical, I think it's important to have a little bit of self-check. You don't want to get complacent with these things.
No, I agree.
Whilst I joke about, I'd love to do some preparation, the sort of day job gets in the way of that, really. But it's about being an expert in your knowledge area. My golden rule, I remember being a very sort of cocky teenager and thinking I knew everything. And if I didn't know it, I'd pretend to. And being called out is the worst feeling in the world. It's the opening up of, please swallow me up right now. And I've always, ever since that day, I was about 14, I think. And I got voted to be head girl at a school, 1,200 people at the school. I was very proud of that. And in my opening session, I said, good morning, everybody. Thank you, blah, blah, blah. And it was like mid-afternoon and I died on stage there. I just hated every second of that. And I just remember thinking, this hurts. This feels horrendous. You're so attacked. And one thing that really helped me, and it might help the audience listening in, is just remember that whilst we are always recording these things and whilst people do watch them back and there's often some kind of transcript or notes taken, people in the room only really remember 20% of what you're saying, and the sort of very specific facts can become very misconstrued. That's why it's important to record them and have transcripts. The most important thing is getting the buy-in. What is it that you want them to remember when they walk away? And that's something that I really back you personally, Matt, at the REA for. But the REA in general, like I said, it's the oldest organization there is. You guys have absolutely got this process nailed. Whilst you do have a huge broad range of subjects, I particularly at Pater have benefited from being part of it, because we're trying to drive change and one little voice shouting into the mist isn't going to do anything, but a collective voice certainly does. And it was lovely to be with you and watch your chairing capability as well. And John, you know what it is? There's a room full of people, there's a load of people on screen, and it might just be you've got an amazingly commanding voice, but you just go, we're going to have to move on now. And everybody just listens to what Matt's going to say next. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that is also when I was in college in uni, I was a cox. So I was basically bullying rowers for 6 years. I was shouting at rowers and telling them how to do their job. And, you know, having that also again boosted a lot of my self-confidence and ability to go and, you know, talk and do stuff. And yeah, doing like chairing of meetings is a lot easier when you've basically chaired a whole eight of people who are much bigger than you. and you know,
and we can't throw you into a river like they could.
Exactly.
So you lived in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. So you're light blue or dark blue? I think that's an obvious answer.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Likely.
So you're
yeah.
Cambridge through and through.
Yeah.
And much they've been doing rather well.
My family. Yeah.
Yeah. Cambridge have been doing particularly well. Have you still maintained the rowing, or is that something you gave up?
Oh, absolutely not. No. So I did it all the way through college and undergrad. And by the last year of undergrad, I was captaining one of the teams, and that meant I was basically rowing for about 35 hours a week by the end. So, you know, by the time that year was over, I was like, you know what, actually it'd be nice to take a step back for a little bit. And yeah, as a cox, you've also got to, like, people probably don't realize is you've got to keep your weight down for races and things like that. And so, you know, bear in mind, a cox height is normally about 5 foot, and I'm about 5'11". To keep your body in that kind of shape, you have to diet all the time and do lots of exercise and running, all the rest of it, to keep your weight down. So actually, it was really nice when I finished my last year of uni, of undergrad, to go, oh, I can eat whatever I like now. Fantastic. And I don't have to get up at 4 a.m. anymore. It's great. And so, you know, as much as I miss the odd session, I'm pretty glad just to be, have a bit more time to myself now. Although, yeah, having said that, now that I'm working, 5 days a week of that plus any other stuff I do at weekends, and now I'm writing a history blog as well, so I don't really have much time to do all that stuff.
What area of specialism have you got in history, Matt? What do you study?
So I was always really interested in, like, sort of World War I, World War II history, because that's what you learn at every level, right? So I did it all the way through to A level, and they always make you repeat the same thing every year, all the way to your 18, basically, but just in more detail. So I have a lot of information about that, but then I also quite like some of the medieval history as well. So I was reading about the winged hussars the other day.
Huzzah!
Exactly. They're a really cool Polish cavalry unit that had, rumored to have wings on their back, and they would charge into battle and rain as if they were coming down from the heavens themselves, and destroy the morale of the troops. That's really cool stuff. So I've been, and the blog I've been writing so far has been World War One themed. So I've been doing 1914 and 15, and then 16 and 17 for the second. But it's a slow process, but I quite like it, because it means I can just learn some new stuff every weekend, and really enjoy it.
Constant learning. That story about the Polish, did you say Polish? The Polish flag's got like a white bird emblazoned in the middle, hasn't it? It's the white stripe on the top and the red stripe on the bottom and then the bird in the middle. I wonder if that's how that flag originated. I thought you were going to say that your public speaking confidence, I just always thought you'd be in a band. Are you in a band?
No. But I have a few times got on stage one of my friends is a singer or does a bit of singing, and a few times during school and stuff like that, we would do a talent show and we'd all do a boy band and stuff like that. So we did a cover of a One Direction song that was very popular. We did that for about four nights running for the talent show, and everyone would just come in for ours by the last night, and it was. And then we were asked to perform it again at the end of the year in front of everyone. So the way we made it fun was because, I was notoriously terrible at dancing. I still am. So we would do a thing where in the middle of the song, my friend would turn the music to a country and western theme on the guitar, and then I'd do a barn dance in the middle of the stage. It got very embarrassing. And then by the time the end of the year came around, they're like, what if we do a twist on this and we get you to do a dance off against the best dancer in school instead? And so I have done a few like performance things. And recently a friend of mine had a song about Boris Johnson. And so I did a background dancing dressed as Boris Johnson in one of his, for one or two of his performances, which was actually quite good fun. That did take quite a few beers to pull off, to be fair.
Okay, noted. I hope we get to see this at your REA conference next year. I'm not coming if there's not going to be Boris Johnson barn dancing, just not coming to the event.
It's given me an idea, Sarah. So we're at Carfest in August, and we interviewed Jackie Barker recently, who's a singer, and we have a number of people in the community who are musical. Roger Atkins, of course, with his guitar. I wonder, is there potentially...
Don't look at me. No.
I wonder if there's maybe an EV community band set that we could put together. Liz Allen, of course. Yeah, yes. Absolutely. I think we could pull something together here. Matt, are you up for that? Ooh.
Go on then. Yeah, why not?
What would we be called? So what would the EV community band be called?
Well, you've got to get the REA in there and EV somehow. So is it like Reva?
REA Speedwagon.
What have you done, John? What have you done?
Goodness everyone gracious. Hop on the speed wagon.
EV wagon. Yeah, the REA EV wagon. It's coming. We'll get there. Matt, what's the future hold?
In general? If we look at... For the REA, I think we're going through a period of change at the moment. You probably saw they got a new CEO that's come in over the last few months. So we're looking at a few new growth areas, which would be quite exciting. I can't talk about them now, but just to say that there are some really cool things going to be happening next year, and you'll probably see some of it quite soon, hopefully. In terms of more generally, I think we're going to get to a point with EVs that suddenly this sort of misinformation stuff is just going to disappear because everyone's going to be in them. Even by 2030, we're going to have 9-10 million people in EVs. At that point, suddenly the argument's gone, right? And I can't wait for that day. For me, I think it's more just continuing the same as usual. So, pushing as hard as possible. We've got lots of exciting projects coming up. I've got Probably got a few reports that we're going to be doing next year now. So I think we're going to look at some stuff around curtailment and the role of EVs and that. We've got, as Sarah mentioned, we're doing some stuff on interoperability. So we've got hopefully a survey that will go out to CPOs in the next few weeks, which, you know, we hope will then help shape future policy around, you know, public charge point regs and things like that. It's quite a few buns in the fire.
Buns in the fire? Is it irons in the fire and buns in the fire oven?
Yeah.
That's
buns in the fire.
The future's bright. The future's Matt Adams, I think, is a little catchphrase for this podcast. All I've learned from you this time is just yet more confirmation of who I thought you were. Just absolutely fantastic resilience, incredible public speaking capability, hugely giving, wanting to teach others how to speak publicly, get other people's voices heard through your ability to sift through such incredible amounts of information and digest them and bring them back in a clear and coherent way. Just phenomenal, Matt. I'm just wishing you every single success for your future as your career, but also as a collective. Let's go, let's run with John's idea and get you on a global stage and do a barn dance dressed as Boris Johnson.
Listen, Matt, it's been absolutely superb. Thank you so much. I didn't know you that well. We know each other to say hello to. I do genuinely applaud everything you do and the way you do it. So thank you. It's been a real insight today. And Sarah, as always, beautifully guided through the conversation. So thank you for doing that. If you've enjoyed the EV Cafe and this takeaway, then you can find loads more on social media, LinkedIn and all that stuff, as well as podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, Google. Check them out. Almost 100 podcasts now. And Matt, yours is definitely going to be a shining light. Until next time, thanks everybody for joining us, and we will see you again.